Privately, he warned that it would alienate the generals in Pakistan's high command from the United States. "We understand your geostrategic relationship with India," Musharraf told Republican Senator Chuck Hagel that spring. Yet the Indian nuclear accord was vastly unpopular inside the Pakistani military. Pakistan would now be grappling with the prospect of a nuclear arms race, Musharraf complained, and this would inevitably affect his cooperation with the United States. He cherished his friendship with Bush. "I say he is a friend. He is sincere and open, and we are together in fighting terror." Yet the India deal had created a strategic divide from Washington more significant than personal trust and affection. Musharraf also took note of the Bush administration's decision to hand peacekeeping operations in Afghanistan over to British, European, and Canadian forces. The plan dated to 2003, but was now being implemented. The International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF, was a NATO-deployed military distinct from America's terrorist-hunting task forces around Afghanistan. ISAF troops remained mostly confined to Kabul and cities in Afghanistan's north. The idea now was to spread out first to the north, then to the west, then to the south and east. If Afghanistan were a clock face, that is, the international forces would move from the top of the dial counterclockwise around, fully deploying in Helmand, Uruzgan, and Kandahar by mid-2006. Musharraf and Karzai reacted similarly to this transition. The handover only affirmed what they had feared and predicted. The United States, the world's most powerful military, would not stay the course in Afghanistan. None of the British, Canadian, or Dutch forces planned for aggressive combat against the Taliban. They would support peace and reconstruction in the manner of UN peacekeeping and peace enforcement operations in Africa or the Balkans. "The transition plan makes us nervous and angry," Karzai told American visitors privately. "Afghanistan's stability is a journey still in progress." In Pakistan, Musharraf and the Corps commanders concluded, "The Americans are out the door." As Colonel Tom Lynch, a special advisor at Central Command, who served as a military assistant to Zalmay Khalilzad in Kabul during 2004, put it. Therefore, the thinking of Pakistani officers went, as Lynch summarized it, "We need our proxies," meaning the Taliban, "in as best condition we can manage without being fingered as state sponsors of terrorism." The blindness to Pakistan's intentions in Washington, London, Ottawa, and The Hague would have devastating consequences. The victims included British, Canadian, and Dutch soldiers who encountered fierce combat their politicians and intelligence services had not predicted. And they included many villagers in Helmand and Kandahar who were soon caught up in shocking, often indiscriminate trench and artillery battles from late 2006, an unexpected war sometimes fought at close quarters in thick marijuana, poppy, and grape fields, at other times by assassins, suicide bombers, and Taliban roadside bombing crews. Just as Gul Aga Sherzai's self-enriching tour as Kandahar's governor after 2001 had set local conditions for the Taliban's revival there, Helmand's government of strongmen, narco-traffickers, and opportunists eased the Taliban's return. Karzai's appointed representatives in Helmand included some of the very thugs whose abuses had fueled the Taliban revolution in the first instance. The provincial governor, Sher Mohammad Akhundzada, had ties to the opium trade. Dad Mohammad Khan, a local militia leader from the Alokozai tribe, ran the provincial National Directorate of Security Forces. Abdul Rahman Jan, a warlord from the Nurzai tribe, ran the provincial police. They returned to their ways. The strongmen fought with one another and attempted to fool U.S. Special Forces into targeting the others' militias as Taliban, with some success. And they preyed on villagers. "Day by day, the situation got worse," as a member of a local Helmand council described it. "There was lots of extortion and stealing, and people were killed. Gradually, people got fed up with the Afghan government and welcomed the Taliban back into their districts. Through interviews and surveys with about 150 Taliban commanders and unaffiliated tribal elders in Helmand, the researchers Theo Farrell and Antonio Giustosi constructed one of the most granular portraits of the Taliban comeback in southern Afghanistan between 2004 and 2006. The Taliban first infiltrated the area with vanguard teams of two or three people who secretly contacted villagers and elders. As one resident described it, they told the people that they were coming back to the district to fight against the government. The Taliban assassinated Afghans holding government offices. By 2005, they had returned in force to control rural areas, but they did not call attention to themselves by seizing district centers. These Taliban forces included a heavy contingent of Punjabi speakers, that is, Pakistani nationals from that country's eastern and southern breadbasket. There were also Arabs and Iranians. Since 2004, the United States had deployed barely 100 soldiers to Helmand on counterterrorism and minor reconstruction missions. They had no orders or ability to collect intelligence on the Taliban infiltration. They were marauding companies of Alabama National Guardsmen and Ranger squads, who would charge into villages all guns blazing and AC/DC blasting out of the speakers on the PSYOP's Hummer. As Patrick Hennessy, a young British officer who served in Helmand on training missions during this period, put it acidly. In London, there was little genuine intelligence available about how benign or hostile an environment Helmand might present when 3,300 British troops arrived there during 2006, according to a researcher who interviewed Army and intelligence officers, as well as cabinet officials. MI6 and British military intelligence seemed to have warned in classified channels that Taliban leaders in Quetta had decided to target the British in particular as they arrived in theater. Britain's history as an invader of Afghanistan during the 19th century provided an obvious narrative for Taliban recruitment and mobilization. Yet Tony Blair's then Minister of Defense, John Reid, said publicly in April 2006, "We would be perfectly happy to leave in 3 years and without firing one shot." That spring, about 200,000 seasonal poppy harvesters migrated into Helmand, many of them young men ripe for recruitment against the British. Guns, drugs, and jihad, the essence of war against international forces in southern Afghanistan, had not changed much since the Soviet occupation. Poppy production exploded in 2006. The area under cultivation in Helmand more than doubled compared with the year before, according to the United Nations. That upped local incentives to capture the opium trade. To advance clean government, Britain pressured Karzai to dump Governor Akhundzada. The deposed warlord promptly aligned with the Taliban and attacked government posts. All this quickened the coming British fiasco. Hamid Karzai and Akhundzada's successor, Mohammed Daoud, pressured Brigadier Ed Butler to rapidly send British forces to retake territory from the Taliban. "If the black flag of Mullah Omar flies over any of the district centers, you may as well go home," Daoud pleaded. Butler rapidly deployed small British units to isolated platoon houses in Nawzad, Sanjin, Garmsir, and Musa Kala. By the end of May 2006, they were fighting for their lives in a series of alamos, as Lieutenant General Rob Fry put it. The British Gurkha forces in Nawzad held off Taliban who called out to one another in Urdu, Pakistan's national language. "How the hell did we get ourselves into this position?" a British cabinet minister asked a colleague. "How did we go charging up the valley without it ever being put to the cabinet?" The answers included Butler's autonomy as field commander, poor coordination within NATO, and poor intelligence. The failures cascaded. Without enough men, armored vehicles, or helicopters for this unpredicted war, Butler relied on close air support, aerial bombing, to protect his stranded men from Taliban sieges. The British platoon house at Musa Kala called in 249 bombs onto enemy positions in a single 10-day period, Just one example of a prolonged barrage that took civilian lives and property. The Taliban exploited the ensuing collateral damage. Homes destroyed, women and children killed and wounded, to recruit local fighters. The forward element of Canada's commitment of more than 2,000 soldiers to Kandahar province, which arrived early in 2006, was called Task Force Orion, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Ian Hope. His domain covered 20,000 square miles of jungle-like irrigated agricultural fields, mountains, stark deserts, mud-walled villages, and the smoky sprawl of Kandahar City. Hope was unprepared by intelligence or political reporting for the widespread Taliban infiltration he encountered. "Where are they?" he would ask Afghan intelligence counterparts. "Everywhere." "What villages?" "All of them." "When?" "Every day." "What about the mountains?" "In the mountains, too." The only way to pinpoint Taliban positions was through reconnaissance by force, which meant driving around until somebody shoots at you, as a Canadian officer put it. That spring, Canadian patrols shot up small Taliban units. They found, in abandoned encampments, propaganda calling on all Afghans to wage jihad against the United States, Britain, and Canada. They also found concentrated opium paste so powerful that if you touch it, it'll absorb into your skin and really fuck you up. The Canadian plan emphasized whole-of-government approaches to assist Afghanistan, a 3D strategy of defense, diplomacy, and development. Canada's defense history included bloody combat at D-Day and in Korea, but since then, the country had emphasized peacekeeping. Canada's development-first assumptions suffered on contact with the Taliban that spring. The guerrillas massed clandestinely in the lush, irrigated green zone to the west of Kandahar. Brigadier General David Fraser, the top Canadian commander, judged that the Taliban intended to threaten Kandahar, to demonstrate the weakness and the inability of the national government to come after them with a conventional force. This also indicated to us that the Taliban were actually progressing to the next stage where they thought they were capable enough to go and challenge the national government and coalition forces in a conventional manner. This is what Amrullah Saleh reported in his classified paper that spring. Fraser thought that the Taliban wanted to draw Canadian troops into the Green Zone in a battle of attrition intended to inflict as many casualties as possible to weaken Canadian resolve and undermine public opinion at home. Fraser's commanders carried around dog-eared copies of Lester Grau's "The Bear Went Over the Mountain," a history of Soviet military experience in Afghanistan, which made clear that as the Taliban dug in during 2006 along the walled, vine-thickened fields beside the Argandab River, they were only following a plan with a successful precedent. Canadian forces launched Operation Mountain Thrust on May 15th to defeat the Taliban in their traditional areas. Canadian forces took casualties, but inflicted many more. Their officers interpreted the campaign as a decisive triumph. On June 4th, the Canadian journalist Graham Smith, who had moved to Kandahar, joined a convoy summoned by Canadian military public relations specialists to declare victory. Suicide bombers struck the convoy en route. Charred pieces of human flesh stuck to the armor. The journalists assumed the victory ceremony would be canceled, but it went ahead. "Four successive strikes against the Taliban broke the back of their insurgency here," Colonel Hope pronounced. By September, the Canadians had come to realize that every time they pulled back from a firefight to refit on their bases, Taliban reinforcements slipped in to take up the positions vacated by their departed martyrs. "It was like digging a hole in the ocean," Fraser reflected. American Special Forces reconnaissance units patrolling the vast, unpopulated Registan Desert on the southern flanks of the Canadian deployments found evidence of why Taliban supply lines were so resilient. One patrol stopped a convoy of trucks manned by civilians in local dress who claimed they were gasoline smugglers trafficking with Iran. In fact, they were smuggling arms. The Americans found a current Pakistani military identification card that a driver had hidden under his truck's dashboard. Operation Medusa followed during the first 17 days of September, the largest NATO land battle in the alliance's 60-year existence. Canadian forces rolled into the Green Zone and won violent, dismounted firefights with Taliban fighters who were protected by vineyard structures and irrigation ditches. Fraser estimated there were about 500 Taliban fighters embedded in the Green Zone, and that only 200 of them were hardcore. But a special forces linguist assigned to listen to Taliban radio chatter soon estimated that there were 1,000 or more. 4 Canadians died in the initial assault, and casualties mounted in the withering heat. Again, after Medusa, the Canadians and their Afghan allies declared victory. "The ability of the Taliban to stay and fight in groups is finished," Asadullah Khalid, the longtime CIA ally and young confidant of Hamid Karzai, who was now Kandahar's governor, announced on September 17th. "The enemy has been crushed." It was not evident, even to senior American diplomats posted to Afghanistan during 2006, that the Taliban had acquired momentum. "The increased number of suicide attacks remains deeply disturbing," reported a Kabul embassy cable to Washington on April 24, 2006. "The police needed more guns and ammunition, and Afghan soldiers in Kandahar needed to form a quick reaction force to respond to pop-up Taliban attacks. Yet there was noteworthy good news from southern Afghanistan," the cable added. "So far this year, the Taliban do not appear to have the capability to recruit or field as many fighters as they did last year." To the extent that America's Iraq-distracted intelligence apparatus examined the Taliban threat closely, it focused across the border in Waziristan, where al-Qaeda had embedded and where American signals and overhead collection was expanding. There, too, in early September, the Bush administration received a shock. Musharraf's government announced a peace deal with tribal elders, Taliban commanders, and foreign fighters in North Waziristan. The Taliban said they would not cross into Afghanistan or mainland Pakistan to carry out attacks. The agreement had no enforcement mechanism. Pakistan released scores of jailed militants and promised never to prosecute the militants for past crimes. The army dismantled recently established security checkpoints, promised to staff older checkpoints only with local tribal militias, returned previously seized weaponry and vehicles, stopped all military operations, and paid compensation for damage from past operations. The U.S. consulate in Peshawar noted that many observers were skeptical that the agreement would effectively reduce cross-border attacks on coalition and Afghan forces or halt the spread of Islamism in the long term. That would prove to be a considerable understatement. The Waziristan peace deal's architect was retired Pakistani Lieutenant General Ali Mohammed Orakzai. Musharraf had appointed him governor of Northwest Frontier Province earlier that year. The governor also oversaw the federally administered tribal areas. Orakzai was a Pashtun. His family hailed from one of the smaller tribal agencies. The position of Pashtun army officers, who made up about 20% of the Pakistani military officer corps, the largest ethnic group after the dominant Punjabis, was complicated. General Orakzai's local contacts and credibility among Pashto-speaking tribes struck Musharraf as an asset. For his part, Orakzai urged Musharraf to give peace with his brethren a chance. The military incursions in the FATA, urged by the Americans, had failed. Rather than attack the tribes, Orakzai argued, Pakistan should negotiate to restore their autonomy, in exchange for loyalty to Pakistan's core goals and interests. Once peace was established, Pakistan could provide jobs and services that would cement the tribes to the state. Musharraf flew to Kabul on September 6th. The Afghan government arranged for him to address about 400 members of parliament and religious leaders. Hamid Karzai was reluctant to accompany Musharraf personally to the speech, for fear of being seen as soft on Pakistan. but the American and British ambassadors persuaded him to do so. In his remarks, Musharraf drew a line between Pakistani policy toward the Taliban before 2001 and now. He said Pakistan no longer sees the Taliban as representing Pashtuns. His peace policy in Waziristan was designed to empower non-Taliban moderates through investment and development. In a rare concession, he acknowledged that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were active inside Pakistan, as they are in Afghanistan. Yet he took pains to make distinctions between good and bad Taliban. He argued that Afghan and Pakistani security were mutually dependent, and he concluded by reading, in Dari, a few lines of Afghan poetry. "Whenever there is trouble in Afghanistan, there is trouble in all of Asia." Musharraf and Karzai flew on to Washington. Bush greeted them in the Rose Garden. At dinner in the family quarters of the White House, Musharraf sold the North Waziristan peace deal as forcefully as he could. "Give it a chance," he urged Bush. He spoke for more than 30 minutes, sugarcoating the facts and overselling the potential benefits, as Condoleezza Rice put it. Karzai interrupted at last to say that Musharraf had cut a deal not with tribal leaders, but with the terrorists. Karzai theatrically pulled a translation of the agreement out of his cape and read from it at the table. "Tell me where they are," Musharraf demanded of Karzai, referring to the Taliban's leaders. "You know where they are. If I did, I would get them. Go do it." Later it would become commonplace for American officials to describe Karzai as erratic, corrupt, ungrateful, or all three, off the record at first, then publicly. In late 2006, there was little basis for such an accusation. Tethered by his close personal relationship with Bush, and still willing to bear the political fallout at home from American mistakes, Karzai spoke out publicly and elegantly in defense of Bush administration policy, even though such advocacy risked reinforcing the Taliban's relentless propaganda that Karzai was nothing but a puppet of Western powers. Bush checked in with him regularly in order to lift his spirits and assure him of our commitment. Yet while he offered advice and made requests, I was careful not to give him orders. Years later, Karzai dated the first deterioration of his relations with Washington to 2005, when civilian casualties caused by American bombing first became untenable for him. Yet even then, Karzai recalled, I had a very good relationship with President Bush, and we had not experienced what we experienced later, by way of stinging personal criticism of his rule. As late as the autumn of 2006, in television interviews, in speeches, Karzai's principal complaint was not American arrogance or civilian casualties, but Pakistan. Musharraf was not doing enough to deprive the Taliban of a base of operations on its soil, and Afghanistan was paying the price. The Waziristan peace plan was now official Pakistan Army policy. Soon, American military officers in Afghanistan encountered John Lennon's immortal plea in bold letters on PowerPoint slides presented by their Pakistani counterparts. Give peace a chance. In the next slide, the Pakistani officers would brief on Karl von Clausewitz's familiar observation about war as an extension of politics. Some of the American officers who endured these presentations could barely contain themselves. Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry commanded American forces in Afghanistan during 2006. He was in the midst of the second of what would prove to be three tours in the country. He was a West Point graduate who later earned graduate degrees at Harvard and Stanford. He had a reputation as a demanding character who could be difficult to work for, but who had a sharp and independent mind. When he arrived in Afghanistan, Eikenberry toured frontline bases and heard from diverse S-2s, the field military officers in charge of intelligence, about the enemy's infiltration routes and supply lines. The tactical picture was impressive in its specificity. His S-2s put up PowerPoint slides with red diamonds to mark cells and lines running into Pakistan. "Where does this go to across the border?" Eikenberry asked. "General, we really don't know," was the typical answer. Joint Special Operations Command and the CIA, didn't want to be distracted by fights against the Taliban in the interior of Afghanistan at this time, in Eikenberry's experience. They were focused on the borders and Al-Qaeda. The tensions between CIA officers based in Kabul and Islamabad that had flared during Zalmay Khalilzad's ambassadorship remained. Kabul station felt Islamabad was naive about ISI complicity, while Islamabad defended the partnership. The fights were so intense that Eikenberry felt that if two dear twin brothers were assigned respectively to serve the different station chiefs, they would hate each other within 24 hours. Eikenberry flew to Quetta and Rawalpindi with CIA and intelligence officers to present classified briefings to Pakistani counterparts about Taliban sanctuaries inside Pakistan and the ease with which Taliban forces were flowing into Afghanistan. The Pakistanis would admit nothing, and countered with briefings of their own about sanctuary Afghanistan provided to fugitive violent guerrillas from Pakistan's Balochistan province. On Al-Qaeda, they could still do business. But on the Taliban, the CIA and ISI settled now into a dead embrace informed by accusation and denial. Chapter 13. Radicals. In May 2006, British security services asked Ashfaq Kayani at ISI to watch Abdullah Ahmed Ali, a Londoner traveling in Pakistan. It had been less than a year since four British-born suicide bombers detonated themselves on London underground trains and a double-decker bus, killing 52 people. A second attempt 3 weeks later failed narrowly. The problem of violent extremism among British Muslims was complex, but Pakistan was part of the story. About 825,000 people of Pakistani origin lived in England. Every year, at least 250,000 people traveled between Pakistan and Britain. Identifying violent radicals within that flotsam became an urgent priority for British intelligence after 2005. Cooperation from ISI's Directorate C, the Counter-Terrorism Division, seemed essential, given the needle-in-a-haystack dimensions of the problem. Abdullah Ahmed Ali was then 25 years old. He had been born in Newham, a low-income borough of East London, to parents who had emigrated from Pakistan's Punjab. He was one of four brothers. His eldest brother was a technology consultant. Another worked part-time for the London Underground. The third was a probation officer at the Home Office, which oversaw the British police. None of them had a criminal record, nor did Ali. Yet Ali's frequent travel to Pakistan and his contact with other Britons under surveillance as terrorism suspects had led British services to request ISI's help. A cousin picked Ali up at Islamabad's international airport and drove him toward the family's home village, Jhelum. Pakistani police stopped the car and searched it, but let the men go. In his village, Ali learned from relations serving in the local police that ISI was on his case. The suspicions about him were well-grounded, as it happened. Ali had entered into a conspiracy with Al-Qaeda to carry out spectacular bombing attacks in Britain. His main contact was a fellow Briton, Rashid Rauf, who was now living as a fugitive in Pakistan. Rauf had left England in 2002 after falling under suspicion in the stabbing murder of an uncle. He had since joined up with an Al-Qaeda bomb-maker from Egypt known as Abu Ubaidah, who worked out of the federally administered tribal areas. By May 2006, when ISI picked up Ali's trail, the conspirators had completed experiments on potent liquid explosives manufactured from hydrogen peroxide, hexamine, and citric acid. Their formula could disguise a powerful bomb as a colored sports drink to be detonated by ordinary AA batteries. Initially, the group had planned to strike oil or gas refineries in England, but by May, they had discovered that their bombs might be smuggled aboard commercial airliners and detonated at altitude, bringing the planes down. Rauf and Abu Ubaidah had recruited Ali to lead a team of bombers that might destroy half a dozen or more packed airliners over the Atlantic as they flew from London to the United States. If the plan succeeded, it would be the most devastating Al-Qaeda attack since September 11th. After leaving his village, uncertain how closely he was being watched, Ali met Abu Ubaida in Waziristan, studied the latest bomb design, and flew back to London carrying notes scribbled to himself. Clean batteries, perfect disguise, drinks bottles, Lucozade, orange, red, Oasis, orange, red, mouthwash, blue, red. Calculate exact drops of Tang plus color. Select date. 5 days before. All link up. Prepare. Dirty mag to distract. Condoms. One drink used, other keep in pocket. Maybe will not go through machine. Put keys and chewing gum on D in the elect device. Keep ciggies. Camera cases. The drinks that you drink should be diff flavor. The London underground bombings of 2005 had appeared to be homegrown. The bombers' pre-recorded martyrdom testaments emphasized their opposition to the Iraq War and Anglo-American occupation of Muslim lands. Their grievances suggested that the provocation of the U.S.-led Iraq invasion had led dispersed, isolated individuals to take action in the name of Al-Qaeda or its ideology. In the absence of initial hard evidence about how the underground bombers had made their relatively simple bombs, packed into lumpy backpacks, the British government was cautious about whether Al-Qaeda had a role. A year later, however, surveillance of Ali and his conspirators, among other intelligence, had brought a revised picture into focus. Ralph and Al-Qaeda bomb makers had in fact aided the underground bombers decisively. Between that case and this latest one, it was becoming clear that an evolving Al-Qaeda consisted of both a new wave of dispersed, angry Muslims inflamed by American and British foreign policy, and the residual skilled Arab terrorists who had fled Afghanistan to hide in Waziristan after 2001. Following the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, shocked by televised images of Afghan refugees seeking shelter from the American-led air war, Ali had volunteered at a London charity, the Islamic Medical Association. It ran an ambulance service in refugee camps near Chaman, the Pakistani town on the border with Afghanistan, to the south of Kandahar. Later, with one of his older brothers, Ali joined street protests against the invasion of Iraq. He attended the huge anti-war march in London on February 15, 2003. At the time, it felt good to know you're doing something, you're getting your voice heard, as he put it later. Soon after, he flew to Pakistan to volunteer as an ambulance driver around Chaman. He had never seen such suffering. It's so mucky, smelly, loads of kids running round crying, really like appalling conditions, lots of arguing, kind of chaotic. I don't think anything can prepare you for something like that. Emotionally, it was very straining. Some were maimed. Some had their legs blown off. Some had bits of their fingers missing, scars, burn marks, skinny, rugged, rough-looking faces. There was lots of deaths in these camps, daily. We have to come on funerals almost every day, but it's mostly kids that were dying, children, young children, seeing the mothers going through, pulling their hair out. Ali blamed Britain and America for what he saw. The following spring, he wrote a will that suggested he was prepared for martyrdom. He became less enthusiastic and confident in things like protests and marches. We knew now the war was illegal in Iraq, and it wasn't a secret no more. It was a lie. It was just deceit. It was a criminal war. In my eyes, that made the government criminals. The root problem was the foreign policy, and that's something that should be tackled. On several trips to Pakistan after 2004, Ali connected with Rauf and Abu Ubaida. In June 2006, after traveling under ISI surveillance, he flew back to Heathrow. British police secretly inspected his luggage. They found AA batteries and many packets of powdered Tang. Unbeknownst to Ali, the police then placed him under fuller surveillance, in the hope that they could identify everyone Ali was working with in Britain, so that all participants in the conspiracy could be arrested. Detaining Ali prematurely risked having his case dismissed for lack of evidence. It might also leave other as-yet-unknown conspirators in Britain untouched. The surveillance operation unfolded during a period of rising estrangement between the CIA and British security services. In the second-term Bush administration, some American policymakers had come to think of the French as really a more engaged ally than the Brits, as one senior administration official put it. In Afghanistan, CIA officers from the Paramilitary Special Activities Division dominated Kabul Station and the border bases. Their Omega counter-terrorist pursuit teams operated on their own, without collaboration with the British. Some of the paramilitary types from CIA regarded MI6's Oxbridge types as cerebral and even effete, or so it seemed to the estranged British officials who dealt with Langley. In Afghanistan, the Americans dressed in cargo pants and flak jackets and had beards and were immensely cool and carried a weapon, as one senior European official involved in the war put it. Most of the CIA chiefs of station in Kabul came from the sort of paramilitary wing. The Americans were taking up all the oxygen in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as a senior British intelligence official described it. The CIA has always been very mission-driven, and they thought that we were a bit wimpy and weren't all that useful anymore. It was a difficult time. By August 2006, the CIA had been drawn into the British surveillance operation involving Ali, however. American clandestine technical resources had determined that planning for the strike was coming from North Waziristan, according to Jose Rodriguez, then the head of worldwide CIA operations. Rodriguez had only a vague understanding that British authorities were hoping we would not move too rashly against the surveillance targets. That was an understatement. The Ali case was so sensitive that Prime Minister Tony Blair spoke to President Bush about it to obtain Bush's agreement that the CIA would move slowly so that British officers could identify all the conspirators. The day Blair and Bush spoke, however, Rodriguez happened to be in Pakistan, meeting with Ashfaq Kayani at his home. They had what was becoming a typically tense conversation about whether Pakistan was succoring militants. "I'm tired of you Americans saying we are not doing enough to fight the terrorists," Kayani declared. As if to reinforce his grievance, the ISI chief described an opportunity for joint counter-terrorist action. He reported that surveillance officers following Rashid Rauf, the fugitive Briton living in Pakistan, believed he was about to board a bus and might be difficult to follow further. "We want to proceed with his capture," Kayani said. "Are you with us?" "Let's get him," Rodriguez declared. Rodriguez did not call back to Langley, which would have been the cautious thing, but also would have effectively refused Kayani because Washington never responds instantly. ISI officers seized Rauf on August 25th. That sudden action forced British police to arrest about 24 people in and around London that same night before they could be tipped off. The British were furious. The Al-Qaeda planned to blow up 6 or more civilian airliners flying to America from London remained weeks or months from being attempted. British surveillance meant the plot would never likely have succeeded. And yet the ambition and technical plausibility of the conspiracy shocked the Bush administration. As the CIA documented the threat posed by British-born, Pakistani-trained radicals who could travel easily to the United States, the Americans started to push British counterparts for permission to run their own unilateral operations on UK soil. Eliza Manningham Buller, then the Director General of MI5, the British equivalent of the FBI, had to warn CIA counterparts at one point, "If we find you doing this, we'll arrest you." 6 Britons, including Abdullah Ahmed Ali, recorded martyrdom videos before the arrests of August 25th. Several others may have been prepared to blow up commercial airliners, according to a diary kept by Rauf. As with the testaments recorded by the underground bombers, Ali's group described their terrorism as religiously sanctioned warfare. During the 1990s, bin Laden's writings and interviews describing al-Qaeda's ideology had included arguments for resistance to what he imagined to be American occupation of Saudi Arabia, as well as its military intervention in Somalia and support for Israel. Yet there had also been a millenarian, rambling quality to bin Laden's thinking. By now, the invasion of Iraq and the deteriorating Afghan war had broadened the appeal of bin Laden's messages, attracting literate TV news-watching Muslims genuinely fed up with Western foreign policy and inclined to volunteer for the fight. As Ali put it in his martyrdom video that summer, "We Muslim people have pride. We are brave. We're not cowards. Enough is enough. We've warned you so many times to get out of our lands, leave us alone, but you have persisted in trying to humiliate us, kill us, and destroy us. Sheikh Osama warned you many times to leave our lands, or you will be destroyed." Off camera, someone asked him, "What about innocent people? Surely, just because the kuffar kill our innocent does not mean that we should kill theirs." Ali answered, "You show more care and concern for animals than you do for the Muslim Ummah." The back-to-back American-led invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq had not only attracted new adherents to al-Qaeda, they had revived bin Laden's own confidence in his ideas. After Tora Bora, it had taken about 9 months for bin Laden and al-Qaeda's operatives to reorganize public communication. In October 2002, bin Laden released a Letter to America, seemingly written in reply to the many magazine covers and newspaper headlines in the West asking, "Why do they hate us?" "Here we outline our reply to two questions addressing the Americans," bin Laden wrote. "Why are we waging jihad against you? What advice do we have for you, and what do we want from you?" "The answer to the first question," he continued, "is very simple, because you attacked us. You ransack our lands, stealing our treasures and oil." The next month, Al Jazeera released an audio tape from bin Laden. He spoke about recent suicide and car bombings in Bali, Moscow, and Jordan. The CIA confirmed bin Laden's voice. For the first time since late 2001, there could be no doubt that bin Laden was alive and restored to some sort of leadership role. The Iraq War brought forth a torrent of geopolitical messages from him. At one point, bin Laden offered a truce to European nations if they withdrew from the Iraq coalition. Al-Qaeda bombed train commuters in Madrid in retaliation for Spain's participation in Iraq. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a squat Jordanian radical who had run a training camp in Afghanistan before 2001 but had never met bin Laden, formed a vicious network inside Iraq to strike the United States and Iraqi Shiite allies. Zarqawi's grotesque beheadings on digital video worried bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. They wrote to him to urge less sectarian, less ruthless tactics. Yet bin Laden embraced al-Qaeda in Iraq, as al-Zarqawi's network became known, because it positioned al-Qaeda as a resistance force in the most violent war then taking place in the Islamic world. In June 2006, American warplanes killed Zarqawi outside of Baghdad. Bin Laden eulogized him as a knight, the lion of holy war, and urged that the fight continue. By 2006, al-Qaeda producers in Waziristan and elsewhere in Pakistan had also seized upon the digital revolution to launch a next-generation media arm, As-Sahab. From laptops and wireless hotspots, its propagandists self-published mainly on Islamist websites. Bin Laden continued to communicate sporadically by audio tape and the occasional video. In the 4 years between 2002 and 2005, Al-Qaeda released a total of 46 messages by one independent count. In 2006 alone, it released 58, more than one per week. The Afghan Taliban and its ideological fellow travelers recovered their public voices in similar fashion. In 2005, a splinter group launched a web magazine, Tora Bora. "Can any one of you deny that Afghanistan is an American colony?" one of its writers asked. "Can any Afghan boast about the honor, respect, and sacredness of his homeland without being humiliated and snubbed by the Americans? How is it possible for our young boys to introduce themselves as proud Afghans in the world? How can our women prove their chastity in the presence of the over-drunk Americans? Is there any other way than migration and suicides?" Tora Bora was more eclectic and less brutally strident than As-Sahab. It published essays on electric fish and gardening and offered disquisitions on Islamic history, law, and conduct. Yet the editors returned to certain themes of wartime propaganda. They offered a revisionist history of the fallen Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan, a wonderful peaceful system for the whole world in which the lives and property of all the people were safe. By comparison, foreign masters controlled Hamid Karzai's American-backed regime. The Karzai cabinet was made by the CIA and comprised of formerly exiled Afghans who don't know the geography of Afghanistan, nor do they know the culture and traditions of Afghans. These agents of America invited occupying foreign forces to intrude into Afghan homes and do whatever they like. They kill some of them and kidnap others without telling any information about whether they are alive or dead. Taliban authors repeatedly compared Karzai's regime to the Afghan Quislings who collaborated with Soviet communist occupiers in Kabul during the 1980s. How can their conscience and morality accept it? They call the cruel America a friendly country and dance to that system which has been imposed by the Americans and call it a democratic gift. Don't they see that without their permission, the Americans conduct their operations underneath their noses and send their innocent sons to Bagram and Cuba? In Al-Samud, an official Taliban print magazine revived by 2006, the editors assured readers that the Afghan Taliban were still united under the leadership of its supreme commander, Mullah Muhammad Omar al-Mujahid. The emir supervises all the affairs of the movement through a number of employees who run the day-to-day work, and the emir is the only person who takes decisions after consulting with the Shura on all military, political, and organizational affairs. Al-Samud also promoted al-Qaeda figures such as Zarqawi, whom it eulogized as one of the heroes of the Islamic Ummah and a knight of the Islamic Emirate. The magazine published a guest essay from an Arab al-Qaeda prisoner in Bagram. In print, as in police and intelligence files, there had emerged by 2006 a clear, if virtual, connectivity among Taliban, Arab al-Qaeda, and radicalized individuals in the West, enabled by digital communication centered on grievances around the twin wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The CIA had no counter for al-Qaeda's digital media strategy, nor did the agency have a clue where bin Laden or Zawahiri were hiding. The best-informed CIA analysts had developed a generalized conviction that both al-Qaeda leaders were in Pakistan, but that was about as far as they could get. When Michael Waltz, an aide to Vice President Cheney, obtained clearance to read into the most restricted compartmented CIA and other intelligence collection programs related to al-Qaeda, some so protected that they were listed on classified docket sheets only by their code names, he was surprised to find that some of the operations were very basic and relatively new, a real disappointment. After the overthrow of the Taliban and the scattering of al-Qaeda, it had taken time for the CIA to narrow the hunt to focus primarily on Pakistan. It was not until late 2002, 6 months after Operation Anaconda, that the evidence from Kabul Station and Afghan bases led the counter-terrorist center's Bin Laden unit, Alex Station, to assess that there was not much of Al-Qaeda left inside Afghanistan at all. The leaders had migrated to Pakistan or through Iran homeward toward Iraq and other Arab countries. Chris Wood had taken charge of Alex Station in mid-2002. The Saturday Night Live version of the hunt for Bin Laden assumed the Saudi was hiding in a cave, presumably in Afghanistan or along the Pakistani border. Alex Station's analysts doubted that. It would be hard for someone like Bin Laden to live for long in the rough, in such a barren region, without becoming seriously ill. Alex Station also concluded that other rumors, that Bin Laden had gone to Somalia by sea, or had returned to Saudi Arabia, or had found a refuge in his family's ancestral home, Yemen, were deeply implausible, although it was hard to rule out anything. Gradually, however, by 2004 or 2005, the unit's analysts mainly visualized Bin Laden in a Pakistani urban area, in a refuge comparable to the ones Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Zubaydah, and Ramzi bin al-Shib had found after 2001 in Rawalpindi, Faisalabad, and Karachi, respectively, before they were each arrested. The Omega teams created in early 2002 by Wood and Rich Blee, blended units of CIA officers and American special forces, supported by clandestine Afghan militias, had been designed to carry out reconnaissance by force, to project intelligence collection inside Pakistan's tribal areas on the ground. The border base design worked reasonably well in 2002 and supported Operation Anaconda. When Al-Qaeda-affiliated Uzbeks and some Arabs regrouped around Wana in South Waziristan, local reporting agents run by the CIA out of the Omega base in Shkin collected useful insights, according to participants. Yet the team's overall record in reporting on Al-Qaeda's two most senior leaders was spotty to poor. Nor did the embedding of CIA officers inside Pakistani military forts in South and North Waziristan produce any breakthroughs in the search for Bin Laden and Zawahiri. The border operations did produce false positives. Early in 2005, toward the end of Blee's tour in Islamabad, Blee and Ambassador Ryan Crocker fought to call off a Navy SEAL raid on a suspected Al-Qaeda compound in the tribal areas, based on a single source, because the intelligence hadn't been vetted. The source had reported Zawahiri might be there. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld approved the strike and ordered strict secrecy, so that neither Blee nor Crocker had been informed of the plan or the intelligence on which it was based. Blee's experience was that it was never wise to launch a high-risk cross-border raid on the basis of human sources alone. Half the time, agents are lying or confused. "You might kill a couple of Al-Qaeda guys, but it won't be worth it," Blee warned. "You're invading Pakistan. You're going to kill a bunch of women and children. It will be a fiasco. I'm not defending you." Blee woke up Crocker, who called Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. He laughed grimly. "We're fucked up here." Some of the planes were in the air when the order was finally issued to stand down. In Afghanistan, the operators stranded on the tarmac or ordered back in flight were appalled. They believed that a Libyan Al-Qaeda operative named Abu Faraj al-Libi might have been meeting with Fakir Muhammad, a Pakistani Pashtun militant leader, and Zawahiri. After that abandoned attempt, a JSOC team manned by Army Rangers did clandestinely strike a suspected Al-Qaeda compound in the tribal areas in early 2006 and made arrests, but did not capture significant leaders. The raid was neither detected by Pakistan nor announced by the United States. By coincidence, the undeclared American raid took place just as militants in Waziristan overran a Pakistani base, killing soldiers and distracting the Army command. In 2005, in a paper titled Inroads, a CIA analyst at Langley tried to reframe the seemingly endless search for Bin Laden by identifying four pillars most likely to revive progress: the Saudis' courier network, his family, his communication with Al-Qaeda operators like Abu Ubaidah, and his media statements. The analyst's paper would prove influential over time. But in the meanwhile, she and her colleagues wasted long hours studying the flora and outdoor videos where bin Laden appeared, or studying the crawl lines on Al Jazeera broadcasts for coded messages. The agency became distracted by bureaucratic and leadership problems after 2004. The Bush administration midwifed the birth of a new intelligence coordination agency, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, a reform proposed by the 9/11 Commission to address failures of intelligence sharing among diverse spy agencies. Inevitably, infighting over the new agency's prerogatives and budget role drew CIA managers into prolonged interagency struggles. Congress also created a new National Counterterrorism Center, a second CIA rival that focused on analysis but inexorably bled the CIA's parallel counterterrorism center of vital resources, as Robert Grenier, the former Islamabad station chief, who is now back at Langley, put it. On the seventh floor, CIA Director Porter Goss never recovered from the high-level resignations of career officers soon after he arrived. The agency surrendered some of its political and operational crown jewels, such as the role of delivering the president's daily brief in person to the White House, which became the responsibility of DNI. Jose Rodriguez appointed Grenier to run the Counterterrorism Center. After he read into the failing hunt for bin Laden, he concluded that Alex Station itself was a serious problem. Long-serving analysts dominated the bin Laden unit. They were among the very best al-Qaeda experts we had, Grenier felt, and their devotion was legendary. Yet the more senior among them had become sometimes arrogant and obsessive and regularly alienated the geographic divisions on whose support we depended. They were definitely a handful to manage. Several of them still had photos of Michael Schur, the unit's first leader, on the walls of their offices, like shrines. The unit had become an anachronism, Grenier concluded. It focused on the core al-Qaeda organization, but after the invasion of Iraq, al-Qaeda was metastasizing, forming new branches across the Middle East. The target's changing shape created fresh conflicts and confusion between the CIA's geographic divisions and the Counterterrorism Center. Grenier decided to reorganize ALEC out of existence. He defended the changes by arguing that the same people, in the same numbers, continued to pursue the same targets, very much to include bin Laden, but in a more rational structure. Yet the reorganization of the core al-Qaeda mission team was one more disruption in a long season of them at Langley. The CIA decided to work much more independently from ISI as early as 2005, according to British counterparts. Joint Special Operations Command added Task Force Orange specialists in human source recruitment, analysts from the Army and Navy Reserves, and NSA intercept teams to the Omega bases, despite the resource strain of the Iraq War. Since human agent recruiting had proved to be difficult, the push concentrated heavily on signals intelligence collection against cell phones and email. There were few predators available. The production line went straight to Iraq. A handful of serendipitous walk-in agents, Pakistani or other volunteers who approached the United States with information about al-Qaeda or the Taliban to sell, provided a baseline of phone numbers and locations in Waziristan and other parts of western Pakistan. During 2006, amid an interrogation at a JSOC prison in Afghanistan, an Uzbek prisoner directed his interrogators to a wheel duffel bag he had been toting at the time of his arrest. The Americans found a false bottom with a folded-up paper containing coded information about al-Qaeda safe houses and contact numbers in North Waziristan. This and other CIA mapping operations in Waziristan set the stage for a coming surge of unilateral lethal drone operations on Pakistani territory. Porter Goss resigned as CIA director on May 5, 2006. After less than 2 years in the position. Bush named as his successor Air Force General Michael Hayden, a former National Security Agency director. Originally from Pittsburgh, Hayden was a balding, management-oriented leader who communicated well in meetings, understood bureaucracy, cooperated with reporters, and got along with diverse colleagues. His consensus-driven approach did not always succeed. While running NSA, relying on the judgments of his senior analysts,